had these young American officers.
Yeah.
The ones I met were never had any higher rank than captain, and they were a bunch of dandy boys. They were really good kids, and they really worked with these fellows. And they had, when I arrived at Penyangdo, one lot of them had been pretty badly mauled. They'd gone ashore and they'd got into some sticky messes, and some of them got hurt pretty badly. And so the morale was a bit low, and they weren't too keen. And the young American, he got them all worked up and got them ready to do it all over again. And he asked me if I'd support the operation. Mm-hmm. And, well, I was only too willing. It was no, you know, it was kind of fun to think that we're going to do something out of the ordinary. And I asked him if he had anybody trained as a bombardment liaison officer. And no, nobody was trained that way. So we designed a grid for him, you know, just took the map and put it into a grid. Very simple. All his corporals were taught. They wanted gunfire. All they had to do was able one, able four. It took a square, which was about a mile square, and cut it into four parts, A1, 2, 3, 4. Mm. And that's all I had to be able to say, able one, or fox one, or fox four.
And communications?
We had good communications. They had walkie-talkies, and they could get to us. Mm. And they called for fire where they wanted it, and we put it down. We could put it down very accurately for them. They just loved it there. They were out there with the whole... whatever did a battalion have
six
4-inch guns.
2.46, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
And fast, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know how fast we can be, yeah.
Right. And anyway,
how
idea
fast,
was,
by the way, just excuse me, just as a matter of interest, professional interest, from the time they called for fire, how soon were shells landing where they wanted them?
Just minutes. Oh, you know.
5 minutes.
Oh, no, not much. Nothing like 5 minutes. 2, maybe?
Yeah. Marvelous. Marvelous.
Oh, it was, they were just exactly what they wanted. Of course, we were at anchor, you see, in the channel, so our position was absolutely fixed.
Yeah.
Just as soon as we had the thing that the TS would put the... Put the guns right straight on where they had to be, and bang! And the next minute, the smoke was coming up from what they wanted.
Oh, I envy you.
Oh, they loved it.
I envy Doug Tutt.
Well, I guess you would. But anyway, when this was all over, the Belfast got into the act too.
Yeah.
I let the captain of Belfast know what was going on, and he said he'd drop a hook and let a few rounds go, and he did either, not very many, but they put a few 6-inch bricks down at one time. So here this one little battalion of guys that had 6-inch guns before, and we had Mayday support from a carrier.
Yeah.
We couldn't commit them to the operation because they had their own target to run down. But if the situation got tough, all we had to do was mayday them into position, and those pilots would be there in a second. And we did in the morning after one little group got in a bit of trouble, and it was we couldn't put fire down without the enemy without hurting them. So they were so close together. So we called a mayday, and the aircraft came in and picked up the situation and strafed the enemy, and these kids got away. Oh, they had a great time. And then I had what the nicest part for me was that they were just thrilled with all this. They'd not had any real war like that where you had, you know, you were better equipped than the enemy.
Yeah.
And a couple of days after the operation, I received the most beautiful illuminated address signed, the English in it is just out of this world.
Flowery.
And signed by each of the the Wolfpack leaders and the American captain, and I was made an honorary member of the Wolfpack with badge and all. Best decoration I ever got. And more fun. And the fact that we'd set the thing up for them so that they could use us properly. No, that I think that was slightly different. The East Coast was very different. We did quite a lot of bombardments, more for the sake of bombardments than anything else. There were quite a number of areas where it didn't hurt to go and have a go at them. And so we did. And at night, the train bashing was a great thing. The first time I arrived, the lines had already been knocked out. But an RN destroyer had got his train and disappeared. And most of the time I was there was trying to keep it out. And so we spent quite a lot of time at night sporadically spraying it. But you couldn't tell. We didn't have air reconnaissance. You couldn't tell whether you're keeping it out or not.
You had to go offshore in daylight hours?
Oh, yes, they had artillery.
Yeah.
If you ventured in, you knew you were going to get shot at. When we got hit, I had enough knowledge of what was likely to happen to say to one or two people, you know, get the first aid stuff very handy. This could quite easily lead to a little bit of bloodletting.
Why were you in there that particular time?
Because we didn't know, we couldn't find out whether the lines were open or closed. We thought we'd be able to tell a little bit more about it if we went in and had a look. And so that's what we did, and I did it when I could be seen. Not expecting to get hit. They didn't have radars. They had triangulation methods, and we were going at a fairly good clip, so I didn't think there was too much chance. But they opened up us, and they had a lucky shot and hit us. But from then on, we had to treat the place as though it was operative again, and so we were going in. At night, we'd be about 2,000 yards off the beach, watching for the train. Mm-hmm. We never did see a train. But it wasn't because we weren't looking.
No. Well, I know John Bovey claimed plenty.
It was quite easy because they came out of tunnels.
Yeah.
These little breaks in the...
Between the hills.
On the shore, You could if you had a pair of night glasses on a half decent night, you could see them coming out of the. There's no problem. All you had to do was have the range on and let her go.
Yeah.
And of course our ranging was very accurate because you knew how far the tunnel entrance was from the beach and you could measure your distance on a radar set.
Yeah.
And. I think anybody who missed probably did it because he didn't use at the point where the range is so low that the dip and overrides the angle of
elevation.
Yeah, and therefore you have to make special spotting regulations.
Yeah.
So anybody who'd forgotten that might have had a little difficulty.
Tut was in the TS, not the bridge.
TS.
Yeah.
Oh, the bridge didn't do anything to those ships at all, except to say, you know, look out, Baron Green 3-0, there's something coming now, get on it, you know, enemy in sight.
It's
and the binoculars in the directors were good enough that they could see just as soon as the bridge could see.
It's interesting how much naval battles changed from 1941 with the advent of radar to the time we're talking about.
A lot of other things changed too.
Like?
Night steaming in a convoy, night steaming in a fleet.
Oh yeah, without radar.
Well, when they got radars, then they could do things that they'd never been able to do before.
Yeah.
And so quickly.
Jimmy Hibbert was told by his Captain D, when he was an Iroquois, that he was to fight his actions on the bridge. His captain was old-fashioned and thought that was the captain's place. He, of course, combining tact with common sense, said, aye, aye, sir, and spent his time in the plot, where these are the battles in the English Channel, with the 10th DF. Basil Jones, Captain D. In 44, it had changed that the battles were best fought from below.
Well, all our night actions were that way.
Yeah.
Whenever we did night patrols, everything was from the operations room.
Yeah.
But, not by day.
No.
I don't agree with that by day.
No.
Because you had so much more chance of identifying what you're looking at.
Anything else on your first tour in Korea that you want to mention?
It was just bombarding and... We would contact one of our own boats and think we had a night action on our hands, and scare the living daylights out of them. South Koreans in boats.
Yeah.
And we'd be up alongside of them before they ever saw us.
Yes.
All blind.
Yeah.
Dense fog in there. I was sent up way, way up into North Korea to bring off refugees one night, which was interesting. I was told where to go, where the place was, that's all. I worked for a Marin cruiser at that time, and I was the captain of the cruiser. I wish I could think of his name. But he... it will never come in this interview.
No, it's all right.
And he...
what was the cruiser's name?
He...
it's gone too. All right.
Newcastle? Maybe?
Newcastle?
Newcastle. Yes, I think it was Newcastle.
Newcastle.
Anyway,
you were working for this...
Anyway,
cruiser.
He was a very, very astute captain. He would send for whatever destroyer man he wanted. Of course, I was CANCOM des Fee, of course, then too. So. But he'd say, this is what I want you to do. There's some refugees up here that have to be picked up. They will be in this place at 2 o'clock in the morning. Okay? That's it. No, absolutely no. You work out your own salvation. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. There's no... And it was nice to work with people like that, because we all had lots of initiative. We knew what to do.
Well, you had lots of initiative, and you were all well trained.
But we must have brought off about 40 people that night, and it was. Soul destroying to see these poor people. So all their worldly goods in them. Think about the size of your handkerchief. Lots of them quite old, but mainly family units, whole families. father, mother, children, grandfather, grandmother, and but they you know, you bring nothing into this world and you take nothing out. But in their case, they left everything behind, everything. So they had a lot of courage to do that. Those are the things we did.
Have any fun on leave?
Well, we didn't. I never set foot in Korea.
No.
On leave.
Back in Japan?
Oh, in Japan we always had a very nice time.
Mm-hmm.
No. Dick Steele and I would take a Jeep and go up into the hills and play golf.
Yeah.
Lovely. We were away from all the heat. Very, very pleasant. But nothing very exciting. Mm-hmm. We went to Hiroshima,
yeah,
and had a look at the place where the bomb had fallen. Hardly know what had happened.
5 years later.
Yeah. Oh, some in the area. There were still buildings that hadn't been cleaned up, but the actual bomb site was. Anybody who said that the place would never recover needed their head read.
What you said about the Korean War and about the mayor of Ottawa who would not come to a reunion of Korean veterans because, quote, mm-hmm, she would not glorify war,
mm-hmm,
period, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
You put very well at that lunch we had on Saturday. I do wish you'd tell that story to the naval historian.
Well, I think the naval historian could himself verify what I say about Korean history.
They had been a subject race since the turn of the century, you said?
Yes. What happened was that Japan wanted to fight the USSR and Russia then, of course,
yeah,
in what did turn out to be the Russian-Japanese War. But they had no stepping-off place in the continent. They had to have a place where they could land and take their troops. And Korea then was probably the weakest country in the world, about as weak as Canada is now. The only military they had was the emperor, really the emperor's own bodyguard, his own personal troops. But they weren't anything compared to the tramping Japanese. They were nothing. Anyway, they were merely told that the Japanese were coming and there wasn't much point in trying to defend themselves, so they didn't. And
this would be in 1918 it was mandated to Japan?
Oh, no. This was 1902,
yeah,
roughly, 1902-3. The noises were happening just before the turn of the century, 1899.
Yeah.
And then about 1902, 1903, again, you have to have a book in front of you to make sure of the date, but... And Japan won the war against Russia.
Yes.
So, when peace treaties were signed, Korea was given to Japan as a protectorate. Or what amounted to a protectorate, and they protected it all right. They just took it, I don't think that in history there's any regime of a conqueror being more brutal, more beastly than the Japanese were to the Korean. Total, absolute discipline. And what I was saying then was that I was at that lunch, and the point was that where the mayor of Ottawa had sneeringly said she wouldn't come to the dinner for the Korean veterans because they were there to glorify war, There was another way to indicate that the presence of Korea vets, that one could glorify war and justify that glorification when it came to Korea, because they had been exposed to this terrible, brutal slavery for up until World War II was won. So this is almost, 48 out there, yeah? 46. And since the turn of the century, they had 46 years of slavery. And this is, I told you that they had to change their names to Japanese names. The press was Japanese. The schools only taught Japanese. The Japanese took over every industry, over mines, the forest, the land, everything. And the whole population of Korea was virtually were slaves. And I also said that the only people, as far as I can make out, that ever could guarantee a reasonable livelihood of for their families were the ones who joined the Japanese army. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I feel that the fact of World War II and the what happened during the Korean War is glorifying war, because these people got their freedom from what we did. Or the little part of the victorious side. And now, if you go to Korea, you're going to see a country that's really emerged in a most magnificent way. And the other thing that you see when you go there are the people that they're not nationalistic, they're patriotic, and they're wonderful people that way. And so what I was trying to make out was that sometimes when I speak, I glorify war, and I glorify it under those terms. It's not the glorification of killing people, and it's not all in remembrance of the dead. It's that something would happen that was good. And I think you can use the same argument, for example, with the fact that 26 million people died in German prison. Therefore, the World War II, in some ways, there's something glorious about it, because that stopped. We may not have been entirely successful in the peace, but at least people who were helpless and in prison and couldn't do anything to defend themselves didn't have to die by their millions. And when you think that in the space of about 4 years, a number of people greater than the entire population of Canada was knocked out, was destroyed by murder, you begin to think that maybe war isn't all that bad under some circumstances. And the other little bit I think that the historians might be interested in looking at is the fact that the people who say we glorify war in a sneering kind of way are the people who forced the American armies out of Vietnam, and the vacuum, military vacuum created, allowed the death of some 3 million people. So we can't glorify war in that case, because we didn't do our stuff, or the Americans pulled out at the wrong time. So that was what I was trying to get across.
You talked about the luncheon where a Korean lady asked you, were the Canadian sailors conscripts?
Yes. That was another, I think in that little incident, this very charming Korean woman, whose English was quite good, was really questioning me about the nature of our means of getting people into our armed forces, whether we were conscripted or whether we had army service or naval service or what it was. And that's how I understood the approach to this, the situation in which I was led to say that, that no Canadian in World War II had anything to do with Korea or in the Korean War was in any way conscripted. These are people who had all volunteered their services. And when she realized that here we were coming to Korea with soldiers who were very young and sailors who were very young and who knew really virtually nothing about Korea, couldn't speak the language, and certainly had no interest in there were no spoils of war which were going to be of any use to them, and this was just pure sacrifice. And I think she must have had sacrificed one of her own sons, but when she thought of a Canadian mother who lost a boy out there, she just couldn't believe that there was anyone in the world who would do what we were doing. And this, of course, and when I told her, she was so emotionally conscious of this that her eyes filled up with tears. They trickled down her cheek. And I can understand her feeling. Of course, we as sailors wouldn't look at it that way, but some women who thought of their children in that light most certainly would, and that's what happened. And to me, it brought home that sacrifices were appreciated by people. This was the kind of thanks that no one would ever give you. But those tears were the thanks that told me that the three Canadians in my ship who were lost were justified. Not glorifying war, but the overall result of what happened gave so many people peace and freedom that it was wonderful. Well, that's what I was saying.
Well, thank you for that. Any comment I can make is inadequate. It's marvelous. Where did you go after Korea then, after you returned?
Well, I went to Imperial Defense College.
Jeez, you're a real quill pusher, aren't you? That's just your third go.
Well, I got them all. I had them all. By your name, had a string of little. You know, they always did those in small letters, not capital.
I've often
NDCJSSCIDC
and passed PSC, passed staff course.
That's the first one, PSC, then JSSC, and IDC.
Bill, some people fail the staff course. Now, even if you fail the staff course, you know something. I never understood why those people weren't entitled to put FSC.
Well, you know, that people from foreign lands who went to Oxford, who failed their BA or whatever it was, put failed BA.
Oxon.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, it was better than nothing, wasn't it?
Of course.
Well, it was virtually impossible to fail the staff course. Now, there had to be, I don't know for sure because I don't know all the circumstances, but it would seem to me that anybody who failed the staff course was somebody who, it was a disciplinary problem, not an educational problem. Now, I know of one case where an officer who never did really recover from the war, and who was very alcoholic, and so much so that he should never have been sent there. It wasn't his fault. But anyway, he got into trouble.
There are lots of war casualties besides deaths.
That's right.
We know that. Anyway, I'm getting frivolous now, and I shouldn't. We've done, thanks to you, what I came here to do. We finished the Korean War on a very nice note, for which, on behalf of Dr. Douglas, I thank you.
You're welcome. Bingo.
How do you like that? Just running out.